Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme. It's our birthday! Monocle 24 marks 10 years of broadcasting this week, and The Urbanist has been there from day one, so we decided to join the festivities too. To celebrate, we're looking back at the last 10 years of urbanism, speaking to a few old friends, exploring a project even older than us, and looking ahead to what the next decade has in store. All that and more coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to this week's episode, and we want to start with a thank you. Thank you for sticking with us over the past decade and helping us turn the world of urbanism and city living from a niche topic into a subject that concerns us all. And after all, cities are fun, aren't they? Well, one of the people who has been part of our journey since episode one is Peter Rees. Peter was the City Planning Officer for the City of London from 1985 to 2014. And now he's a Professor of Places and City Planning at the Bartlett School of Planning. We wanted to hear from him to understand just how much the city has changed since we first began broadcasting, and who better than the man responsible for leading the planning and regeneration of London for decades. Well, Peter, thank you for joining us today. We've seen you many times over the past decade, and we've talked about the city and the financial centre here. Where do you think we are now in the revival of the city following the past 18 months?
Well, to start, Andrew, can I say happy birthday, The Urbanist?
Thank you very much.
It's good to have shared the journey on and off over the last 10 years, and good to be back. Cities, urban places are very important to our society, to our development, to humanity. Even without the last 18 months where I, for one, have been exiled on Planet Zoom trying to teach students all around the world, finding it extremely difficult because of the limited means of communication you have when you're online. Even before that, cities have been somewhat under threat, and a threat from a belief amongst many people that you can have communities which are dispersed, virtual communities, communities linked basically online through an interest, through a cultural affiliation or something of that sort. Now, I'm a strong believer that communities need to have a geographical identity. They need to have an association with place if they are to be true communities. Because communities of human beings depend on such simple things as gossip. To me, gossip is the glue that binds us together. It's the reason we go to a particular place, because we think we'll pick up the hottest news. I think I've said in the past that, you know, even in a desert amongst a nomadic community, people go to a waterhole not just to get water, but to get the latest news about their neighbours and to take it home. It's just the same in an English pub, in a New York bar. And if we believe that we can get that all online, then we are depriving ourselves of a great deal of important information and a sense of connectedness, a sense of connectedness which is creative. Places like the City of London know that if you bring people from different cultures, from different countries, into the same room to work together, where the younger can be mentored by the more experienced, where people share much of their social life as well as their working life, you get an awful lot more out of people. You get a lot more bright ideas, and a lot more of them come to fruition. So I do hope that the place will survive not only the internet and the new forms of communication, but the recent pandemic. And from what I see, looking out from the 27th floor apartment where I live on the edge of the city, there are an awful lot more people coming back to work. And most of them are the young people, because they're the ones that most miss the social aspects of work.
A part of London you know well, the City of London, there we have some very big institutions, financial players saying, actually, don't come back to the office. You know, we don't really need to see you anymore. You're just as effective doing your job wherever you like in the world, almost in some cases. Do you think that's driven then by a naivety, or because there is a sense that they don't value the world of gossip? They're just purely looking at the transactional nature of the work that needs to be done.
Well, it is perfectly possible that the senior people in major financial institutions can be guilty of naivety. I can remember back in the mid-80s, early 90s, they believed they could move their back offices to places like Stratford.
Which didn't turn out to be so much fun for the people who found their jobs moved out. But this notion of gossip, but also of often people meet their partners at work, or they date colleagues, or they go out to the bar at the end of the day and they meet up with people. Oddly, do you think that's the bit that might encourage people back into the office in the end? Because yes, you can do a lot of gossip and things on the internet by messaging people, but you can't have this other odd frisson of like friendship, of potentially, you know, dating someone, as I said, if you're doing that just on a Zoom call.
You've hit the most important part of it, Andrew. I remember back in the tightest days of lockdown when I was making a habit to get out of the flat and walk around different areas. One evening, it was a Thursday evening, I was walking through the deserted streets of the city, deserted by day, deserted in the evening. And in the distance, I heard shouting and laughter. And I thought, gosh, are there something strange going on, a demonstration or something? And I rounded a corner to a street with a number of bars which had traditionally been packed. And outside those bars were young people talking and chatting and socialising. And I realised these were people who couldn't come to work in the city, but they were coming in on a Thursday evening for their usual party night in the city to meet their mates. That's what they were missing. And as you say, the office is very much the centre of social life in this culture where the family is perhaps less important and more people are singles or young couples living in cities like London. The office is very much the focal point of their social life, and that's one of the things that will bring them back. And, as I said earlier, on the other hand, the need for advice, the need for mentoring, the need to feel that they're close to where the action is, even to where the promotion prospects might be.
You work, you live right in the heart of London. Do you feel encouraged then by what you're saying? You're saying you do see more people around. I do something that's akin to going for a run. I went for one this morning.
10 years ago, you told me it was a run.
Okay. And I was actually nicely surprised by seeing how many people were back in their suits, pulling their little wheelie briefcase things along behind them. There's obviously many more people back in the city than I thought. And actually, I thought maybe of all age groups, I know there's lots of people who still don't want to come back and haven't come back. But there does seem to be a sense that maybe you'll begin to feel a little bit left out of things. This sense that you're saying about promotion, about connection, missing out on the gossip, if you're not part of the city. I wonder if that strange old fear of missing out will be more of a lure to get people back to the cities than anything else.
Indeed. And I think it's worth reflecting that the city and other business centres were already in a state of change, or a more rapid change than usual, because they're always in a state of change, but a more rapid period of change before the pandemic began. If you look at the effect of what I call the Shoreditch effect, or in New York, the Brooklyn effect, an awful lot of experienced people and younger people in the financial sector had lost jobs in the financial crash of 2006. And they'd started to set up small businesses. The city spawned a huge number of start-up businesses in Shoreditch because the young people, particularly who'd lost jobs with large corporations, said, if we're going to start a firm of our own, we've got the ideas, where would we do it? And the answer usually was, well, where do we party? We'll be party in the clubs in Shoreditch. Oh, gosh, yeah, there must be some cheap property around there, lots of empty buildings. And that became Shoreditch, on the edge of the city, party central and startup central. Now, you can translate that in New York terms into Brooklyn. Exactly the same thing happened at roughly the same time. That has matured. Of course, where people start businesses, where they choose to congregate, you then get estate agents. And that's where the rot sets in, of course. That's where you get the start of gentrification and commoditization of property. And, of course, property values started to go up in Shoreditch. Developers realized that an apartment block is worth 8 times as much in profitability than an office building. And so Shoreditch, step by step, got gentrified. The clubs couldn't afford the rents. The offices, the startups certainly couldn't. But the interesting thing is, rather than pushing them further away and going off into the provinces, what has happened is that they've moved into the city of London. The largest operator of floor space in the whole of the square mile is WeWork. So those small startup businesses, as they succeed, have wanted to move closer to the centre, closer to where the action is, closer to where they can get the best financial advice, the best legal advice, and all of the other things that go with growing a business. So I've been very pleased with the way that the city spawned Shoreditch, and Shoreditch has given rebirth to the city. Now, I don't know whether that's equally true with Brooklyn and whether that's had an effect on downtown. I get the impression in New York that downtown New York has gone much more residential, much more mixed use, much more like midtown New York. But in London, in the city, it's certainly been true. And Shoreditch has been responsible for the regeneration of the city of London in the last decade. That will continue, that process. And that's wonderful, because the city's always been about small businesses gathering together for increased strength. 80% of the floor space in the city is occupied by firms that occupy less than 10,000 square feet or 1,000 square metres. They're small to medium businesses. The giant corporations account for very little of that space. And as I described them in the mid-80s, these giant financial corporations are the dinosaurs eating their way to the edge of the forest. After all, they've already got to Canary Wharf.
It's interesting what I say. I wonder if I could pick up that, because it makes me wonder whether this notion of, you know, we worry so much about work, but actually maybe play is the more revitalising thing about any city, that if you can make it fun to be in the city, then everything else will follow. Because, again, when you go out of an evening, if you do go to neighbourhoods that are just beyond the centre, if you go to even now to Shoreditch, to Hoxton, to many of the areas that you associate with bars and clubs here in London, they seem to be as busy as ever. And maybe play is the way of luring people back in. And I think it's right when you talk about the commercial heart of the city, that actually they have opened up to more restaurants and bars. And you do see play being used as the way to kind of placemake in a way. And maybe we have to worry less about the number of hours that people have in the office and maybe worry more about the number of hours they have on the dance floor.
Well, in Shoreditch, you know, whenever I've taken my students on walks around Shoreditch, I say, well, you see that group playing five-a-side in the street? You see those people in the coffee bar? Well, you can't see on the roof, but in the middle of the summer, there are people sunbathing up there. They're all working. They're bonding as groups. They're bouncing ideas around as well as balls. And that is part of the new work. In fact, it's interesting. One of my students last year, for her major research project, chose to look at the introduction of adult play streets into Canary Wharf. And I thought it was very interesting, because play is very much a part of work. I mean, look at all the efforts Google go to make work fun. I mean, after they've locked the staff in, of course. But in fact, I think the next thing for Google, when they open their new office at King's Cross, is going to be the only way to be different is to dress everybody up in pinstripe suits and put them in cellular offices. But that's just an idea. Take it or leave it, Google. But Canary Wharf are just as aware of the need for play as most other areas, and the city is certainly aware of this, the need to have better open space, the need to reduce traffic in the streets to make it a more pleasant environment for pedestrians. I've realised for decades that the important mixed use to introduce into the city, or mixture of uses to introduce into the city, wasn't to bring in more residential with the offices, but to bring in leisure, to bring in play. Because the people who work in the city are also the ones that play hardest. And play doesn't fit very well in a residential environment because it tends to make a noise.
Well, perhaps finally, Peter, just as a signpost of where we're heading, we've over the last 18 months heard so much talk about the revitalisation of the suburbs, you know, the shift out of the downtown core by a generation of people. But from what you're saying, do you think that it's going to prove to be a cycle, that there will be a new generation who see opportunity in the heart of the city, a new generation who think, actually, maybe there's a more affordable shop that I can take now, I'll have a go at starting a business. Do you think that we will see in maybe 4 or 5 years that this has just been an odd changing of the tide in a way?
I think there will be a lure towards the bright lights. I can remember when I was 7 years of age, out to play after school one evening, and in those days we were allowed out to play, and seeing a train going past, I lived in Swansea at the time, and that train had a table lamp in each window. It was a Pullman train. I'd never seen one in my life before. And I rushed home and described this train to my father, who'd just got home from work. And he said, oh, that's the Pullman. And I said, well, where's it going? He said, London. And from that moment on, I knew where I needed to be.
Well, there you have it. Peter Rees, thank you so much for being a good partner of The Urbanist over all these years, always throwing up some really interesting ideas. And how nice that we can think about play rather than work as we end this interview. Now, over the years, we've asked Monocle's Andrew Mueller to impersonate different characters of the city, anything ranging from a traffic light to an urban fox. So to celebrate a decade of broadcasting, we've asked him to embody something that's also a decade old, Crossrail. Andrew, take it away.
Yeah, I'm late. 1,000 days late, give or take. Do your own hilarious gags about how Londoners are used to waiting for trains. I've heard them all.
We are sorry that the 11:05 service is delayed by approximately 96 minutes.
Anyway, it's not my fault. If it was up to me, I'd have been finished on time back in 2018 and would now be making myself useful. I mean, I'm a railway. What else would I want to be doing? I derive no pleasure from sucking ever-increasing amounts of your money into this enormous maw beneath your city. The constant grumbling about me being years overdue and 4 billion quid over budget would be a lot easier to wear if it was even slightly any responsibility of mine. Hello, I'm Crossrail, and I've a fair bit to be cross about. Not least is that this whole thing has taken even longer than you probably realise. It was back in 1941 that the famed railway nerd George Dow first proposed a route linking Liverpool Street in London's east to Paddington in the west that would be swifter than the ponderous Circle Line. The idea was floated again in a major study of London's future transport needs in 1974. A pertinent bill was submitted to Parliament in 1991, but the Crossrail Act did not finally receive royal assent until 2008. On which subject, sort of, they changed my name back in 2016. I'm now officially the Elizabeth Line. And whatever, fair enough. It's not the most imaginative choice, but in this rancorous day and age, I do kind of sympathise with whoever had to pick a name that wouldn't cause some sector of the professionally indignant to tee off, but they might at least have chosen someone who'd taken the train to work at least once in their life.
Is there room for the corgis?
The colour scheme they've daubed me with isn't ideal either. Purple is a horrible, compromised shade, a palette evoking, in the specific context of travel, the kind of budget airlines which make you hope for a hijacking to raise the general tone of the passengers. But depending how you count these things, there's already like 14 different lines on the tube map, and all the good colours were clearly taken. Red would have been a neat echo of my finances, but the Central Line snapped that up ages ago. When I'm finished, whenever that is, I will run from Reading in Berkshire to London's west to Shenfield in Essex in London's east, though there is no imaginable reason why anybody would wish to travel from one to the other, and it is already perfectly possible to travel from either of them to London. What people will really think of as Crossrail, sorry, the Elizabeth Line, is the track in the new tunnels, which have been dug inch by torturous over-budget inch beneath London this last decade or so. There are 42 kilometres of these tunnels. Yes, it's been a marathon, not a sprint. Come on, can I get a rim shot? The tunnels have been dug by 8 mighty boring machines. To be clear, this is a testament to their digging prowess, not a suggestion that they are in any respect uninteresting. Look, there's a reason why I'm going to be what you take to get to the Palladium, not what you're going to buy a ticket for when you get there. And anyone planning to one day catch me to a pub quiz could do worse than to note that these monstrous apparatuses have names. Elizabeth and Victoria after the obvious, Mary and Sophia after the wives of the great engineers Isambard Kingdom Brunel and Mark Isambard Brunel, Ada and Phyllis after computer boffin Ada Lovelace and A to Z mapper Phyllis Pearsall, Jessica and Ellie after Jessica Ennis Hill and Ellie Simmons, 2012 London Olympic and Paralympic gold medalists.
We launched Phyllis back in the spring of last year, so we spent 17 months driving her all the way to Farringdon from Royal Oak Portal.
While all 8 are obviously deserving of honour, it's uncertain how they might feel about lending their names to these hefty, unglamorous contraptions which spend their working life in damp darkness churning grimly through rubble and slurry. And I don't know why they're named after women, given that the most remorseless and efficient bores are almost invariably men, and very often men who take a close interest in railways. The most recent best guess for when you'll be able to have a go on me, as it were, is sometime in the first half of 2022, though if we're betting with form, I'd seek alternative routes. Something, something, light end of tunnel, something. I'm a railway, not a speechwriter. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you to Andrew Muller. And you can keep all the boring machines, don't worry. Next up, we visit a topic that's always front of mind here on The Urbanist, density. Back in 2013, we visited the annual conference of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, a non-profit organisation that explores how increased urban density and vertical growth can support more sustainable and healthy cities. Joining me now to look back at that last decade of density and make some predictions for the future is Anthony Wood, Executive Director of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. Anthony, thank you for being here. Now, the Council points out in its very name that it's not just focused on the big and the tall, but also on the habitat created in our cities beside these buildings. Can you tell us about your organisation and what the main goals are?
Our remit is getting less and less about the tall building or the single tall building and really about the future of cities and how it's really about urban density. You know, that's the key point here. Urban density and the concentration of infrastructure, that's really the sustainable way forward for cities. So the vertical growth of a city as opposed to the horizontal growth supported by infrastructure. So more and more we find ourselves concentrating on those subjects rather than just the specifics of a single tall building.
Over the past decade, you know, it was all going swimmingly. Everyone was talking about how our city centres around the world were being rebuilt, made more vibrant. And one of the key things that was happening was this notion of density, that we were building taller towers, which meant that we could have more people living in the centres of cities who wouldn't need public transport or cars. They would just be able to walk everywhere and all the facilities would be wrapped around these towers. Then we had what we all know has happened over the past 19 months or so, the pandemic, where lots of people began to question density and question whether we wanted to live on top of each other or we wanted to live, you know, out in the suburbs and revitalise those. Has the debate changed at all within your organisation, or do you take the long-term view and think, actually, this is just a little bump in the road?
Well, COVID is going to have massive ramifications on every aspect of life for decades to come. And there are a lot of positives that have come out of COVID, by the way. Obviously, terrible, terrible negatives, but there have been a lot of positives. And I think the shift to a certain percentage of home working, or actually anywhere working, not home working, will be with us into the future. And ultimately, that is a positive. You know, I think that will eventually manifest itself into a perhaps a 30% reduction in the amount of office space that we need moving forward. And that might sound a little shocking. And I come to that figure because I think a lot of organizations, including our own, by the way, will settle approximately working in the office 3 days a week. And yet there will be an equal but opposite reaction to that. You know, the nature of the office will change in terms of less density, more kind of spaces to facilitate, you know, people working from home. So I think that will eventually settle into a reduction of office space of maybe 30%, which of course is a massive, massive long term. But what it isn't, Andrew, is number one, the death of the office, number two, the death of tall buildings, and number three, the death of cities. And I'll tell you that if it does go down that path, then we really are screwed in terms of our future on this planet, because COVID and the pandemic has been a massive thing, but there's something that's, you know, just as massive and arguably a lot more massive, and that is that the carbon and the climate change and the whole energy equation and horizontal cities. Now, bear in mind, we are still looking at 1 million new urban inhabitants every week as a long-term trend, population growth and urbanization. That means we need to build the equivalent of Chicago every month. That has not gone away because of the pandemic. There might have been some stuttering in some of this urbanization, of course, but longer term trends, we have a lot more inhabitants. And so, you know, cities still have to develop in a denser, more sustainable vertical pattern to cope with these human trends. And if they don't, if they revert back to the horizontal growth, then it's going to have major ramifications. And really, there is a way to develop more sustainable, dense, vertical cities whilst addressing the issues that have arisen through pandemic. You know, it's And to give you a parallel, a month ago, you know, we passed the horrible milestone, really, of the 20th anniversary of 9/11. 20 years since 9/11. And I can tell you that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, meaning the 6 to 12 months after 9/11, many people said that that would be the death of tall buildings and possibly even the death of the city, but the death of tall buildings. Even people in our industry, you know, the high density tall building industry, thought that people would never, ever be comfortable working, living, recreating in tall buildings. Well, 84% of tall buildings that are in existence today have been built since 9/11.
Let me just dive in though, Anthony. What do you think then about these kind of claims that Saudi Arabia is going to build, you know, a tower that's going to be a kilometre high? Is there any limit for you in the notion of what a tall building could be that's appealing to live in, appealing to work in? Are you for ever taller, ever higher?
No. And what you've got to remember is, you know, there's tall buildings and then there's tall buildings, and they're driven by completely different things. There are tall buildings that are totally 100% driven by a desire for iconography to put a city on the map. I would argue that that's driven most of the world's tallest buildings, very tallest buildings in the last 20, 30 years. You know, this iconography, this using a building in a city to get recognition for the tall building, that is not the same as what I've just been talking about in terms of the 1 million people urbanizing on the planet every week that need somewhere to live, work, and play. So the primary drivers are, in my view, the most valuable driver is what I've mentioned about sustainable dense cities. There's an economic driver, there is an iconography, social kind of attention driver. And depending on which tall building you're looking at, you know, it'll be some interplay of one or more of those things. So you mentioned the project in Saudi Arabia. I mean, it stopped construction 4 or 5 years ago, but it stopped construction at 300 meters tall. You know, I mean, to put that in the context of where you are, it's about as tall as the Shard right now, you know, and it's stopped construction. So it isn't easily going away. You know, it's not like they just cleared the site and put in the foundations. The core is as tall as the Shard, more or less. So I don't know what's going to happen with that project. But if you're pressing me to say, you know, should we be developing kilometer high towers? And is that the way that cities are going to go in the future? The answer is probably no, but I say probably because there is one thing that may change the equation. And that is, we do not know how bad climate change is going to get. And I know this sounds very doomsday, but a very high percentage of cities around the world right now were developed to a set of conditions that are now under major challenge through climate change. Rising seawaters, you know, all the other disasters that we keep seeing. And so we may at some point in the future get to the point where we realize that many of our cities are unviable into the future. And we need to start again with new cities. And if we were going to start again with new cities, number one, they would be located in the most sustainable location, because location is the biggest impact on sustainability, meaning places that don't need too much energy to heat in winter, to cool in summer, close to fresh water, not in earthquake zones, not in rising seawaters. And then the second thing is, would we be then seeking to limit the land use and go with a hyperdensity that may see, you know, towers and density a kilometer or even higher in this multi-layered city in the sky? And I know that sounds like science fiction, and maybe it is, but we don't know how bad things are going to get in the future. We just know that they're going to get bad in terms of climate change.
And finally, just tell us where you think this story is going. You know, we've had this extraordinary 10 years of buildings, many incredible buildings going up. Do you think the numbers are going to just continue rising every year that get built? What's your predictions for the future?
It's going to go one of two ways. We will continue to see more tall buildings because tall buildings are a product of the things I've mentioned. They're a product of population growth, urbanization, the clamoring for attention in competitive local and global markets for cities, you know, competing against each other. All these drivers are still with us and will be with us for another, you know, probably 20, 30 years until population on the planet stabilizes, you know, and may even go then in retreat. But that's another 20, 30 years in the future. So many countries are still developing, and that's before we look at virtually the whole of Africa and other places that still have yet to develop. So I think it will either continue as it is, but I don't think we will see many kilometre-high buildings or proposals for kilometre-high buildings. If you look at what's happened in the US, for example, that perhaps points the way forward for the future. There has not been a proposal for a world's tallest building in the US for 30, 40 years now, because the market doesn't support it, you know, the huge financial investment. And yet, every city in America has seen more tall buildings built in the last 20 years, as I said, since 9/11, than existed before it, of a certain height. So tall buildings have been happening, density has been increasing, but it's not at the massively iconic, mega tall end. But the flip to that, as I've said, could be how the planet might need to evolve and humanity evolve if climate change gets really to a terrible dimension where existing cities become less viable. You know, if a Hurricane Sandy or a hurricane wipes out places like New York on a monthly basis, are we ever going to get to the point where it's like, well, sorry, but New York is just not viable anymore. We can't make it resilient. And therefore, we've really got to rethink cities. And then if that happens, then I think all bets are off in terms of what those new cities could become in so many ways, positive and negative.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us on The Urbanist. That was Anthony Wood, Executive Director of the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. Well, it's almost time to head off, but before we do, we wanted to reflect on the past decade and share some of the lessons that we've learned from all the guests who've graciously joined us here on The Urbanist. Here are 10 lessons drawn from the past 10 years. 1. Cities need to work. We need to be able to navigate the metropolis with ease. If traffic chaos blights the day, then we stop exploring, stop connecting with people and places. 2. But they need to be fun. Sometimes there's too much of a focus on what's smart and connected, and not enough on the joy that the cities we love also deliver. 3. And over 10 years, we've also learned that a key word when making cities is serendipity. We become attached to places that engender surprises. 4. And another good word, layers. Places where history has unfolded, generations of lives have been lived, taken a patina and a glow like that of a well-used chair. 5. Think young, think old. Make cities that are not just perfect for the 20-year-old. 6. But on that, remember that cities should be places with vibrant nighttime economies too. We need to let people be raucous at times and perhaps meet the love of their lives, or even just a good one-night stand. 7. Green space. Lots of it, please. This needs to be the golden age of park making, of public realm where we just want to linger. 8. Safety. And that's not just surveillance cameras. Safety can be designed into cities, because cities should be places that make us feel secure. 9. An open door. Make sure that new arrivals can feel part of a city, become part of its ever-changing story. 10. And resilience. We need to make cities that can withstand whatever is thrown at them, cities that will last and flourish and allow us, their citizens, to look up and say, yes, this is my home. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. So thank you for keeping us company over the past few years. And here's to the next decade together. I think I should just about make it. Well, today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and by David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's show, here's Duthy Fryer with 10 Years. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
We've been together for a decade now. Still every day I'm loving you more. If I could do it all again, I'd probably do it all the same as before.